action against the grain. From radium poisoning to leading gasoline, from cigarettes to global warming, corporations have responded to revelations of grave harm with denial and concealment. As environmental lawyer Barbara Fries notes, a familiar pattern emerges of blaming victims, refuting evidence, alleging witch hunts, and attacking the motives of their critics. She'll join me to discuss the long history of corporate cover-up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Corporations have tremendous power in our society. And when the harm caused by for-profit entities comes to light, their response, as my guest notes, is to wield that power to obscure and tarnish the evidence, whether that means launching campaigns of denial or paying scientists to manufacture favorable research. In Industrial Strength Denial, 8 stories of corporations defending the indefensible, from the slave trade to climate change, which is published by UC Press, Barbara Fries looks at a number of cases where corporations knowingly harmed large numbers of people and responded to critics by whitewashing their crimes. She's a former Minnesota Assistant Attorney General and the author of the book Coal. Barbara, we'll talk in depth about the cases that you highlight in the book of corporate malfeasance and cover-up, but I wanted to start by asking you about what these cases tend to have in common.
Well, I approached this initially in my capacity as an environmental attorney. Back in the mid-1990s, I was working for the state of Minnesota, and I had the experience of confronting the coal industry. They brought witnesses to Minnesota for a proceeding we were having, and those witnesses started to testify about how we did not have to worry about climate change because it wasn't going to happen, and it was going to be pleasant, and all of those other scientists that were warning us otherwise were biased. And so it was a very sobering confrontation for me, both with the climate science and with what I came to see as industrial denial. And it made me wonder how this particular phenomenon had influenced society in the past, what damage had it done, how had other industries basically responded when confronted with evidence that they were causing harm, and how did society react, how and when did society push back, and did it ever overcome those denials. So I decided, after, again, many more years of confronting climate denial and seeing it spread through society, that I wanted to dig into the archives and see how this issue had played out in the past, and that's how I got started on this.
Well, let's start with the first case that you write about, undoubtedly the most appalling of all of them, which is the slave trade. And in the late 18th century, in response to the abolition movement, British slave traders and plantation owners mounted a campaign to justify the slave trade. Tell us about that.
I think it's important to note that Britain at the time really dominated the slave trade, and because the British public knew so little about slavery because it was happening so far away, it gave the industry just enormous leeway to come up with this complete alternate reality. They were being challenged by an abolition movement that was just very directly illustrating the brutality of the industry, bringing forth all kinds of evidence and horrific stories of how the slaves were treated. In response to that, the industry came back with essentially a rescue narrative. They argued that the Africans wanted to be purchased, that they were, you know, treated to an actually festive crossing on the slave ships. They were very comfortable. They were singing and dancing and playing games on the deck. And then when they got to the plantations, they were treated to sort of a cradle-to-grave welfare state where their needs were fully met and they were entirely content. You know, that was one of the responses. There were others, but that was, I think, a particularly, well, brazen one. And it had this weird advantage that By trying to sell this narrative, it meant that slavery was a form of mercy, and it meant that abolition became a kind of cruelty. And that really did, I think, throw the abolition movement for a loop, at least for a while. In retrospect, they were actually incredibly effective and overcame things quite quickly. But this narrative did take hold, and it lasted for a while.
How did the abolition movement eventually figure out how to counter such a campaign of denial and twisting everything so that it was flipped on its head?
I think they very effectively focused on evidence and impressively did that, because, you know, we debate now a lot whether or not facts really matter when you're trying to influence public opinion. But the abolition movement then did not debate that. They were bringing forth witnesses. They were bringing forth some former slaves who could speak to their treatment. They would show diagrams of the slave ships. They would show the torture equipment that the slave trade used. And they appealed very directly to the British public. They had boycotts. They had petitions. And they proved to be very effective. And they went after it, not just, you know, they weren't just aiming for the head. They were aiming for the heart. They were directly challenging this notion that the Africans were something less than entirely human. And in fact, they, one of their mottos, a slogan that was distributed was, "Am I not a man and a brother?" Which, you know, really at this moment in history sounds an awful lot like Black Lives Matter.
Indeed. Tell us then about a campaign that took place in the early 20th century around the dangerously radioactive substance radium, which was used in such products as watches. Can you tell us how it came to be known how dangerous radium was and how the industry then responded?
There were actually two industries that emerged around radium about a century ago in the United States. One related to painting glow-in-the-dark paint onto watch dials and clock dials, and radium was in the paint. And very young women were hired to paint the numbers on the watches. And in that way, they were exposed to lots of radium, in part because they were trained to point up the paintbrush with their lips and tongue. And so it was directly introduced to them orally. The other industry that emerged that is actually much less well known in this country is the use of radium as basically a cure-all. It became a health fad, so that the industry that was trying to create demand for radium actually opened up a clinic in Pittsburgh where people were brought in. They were injected with radium. They were given radium to drink. Eventually, it ended up in all kinds of consumer products that would be sold by mail, and people would drink the radium. It was kind of expensive, so in fact, this was a product that rich people were able to poison themselves with much more thoroughly than poor people. And then the dangers of this radium exposure actually came out in sort of two different waves. First, the young women who were painting the watch dials, they started dying. Their teeth would fall out. Their jaws would, the bones of their jaws would start to decay, and in fact sometimes be removed. They would then die very gruesome deaths, and that made it into the papers. And that did promote some reforms in the industry. By the way, the industry at the time, one of their main responses was that essentially these women suffered from some pre-existing conditions that somehow caused their bones to dissolve, which is particularly astonishing when you realize that they also had radioactive breath. So there was really zero doubt that they had consumed a lot of radium. Somehow, though, the fact that this worker exposure for the poor young women who worked in these studios, the fact that that danger was known, did not stop people from seeing radium as something healthy. It was not until very rich industrialists died in the 1930s, after having consumed lots of radium and his facial bones and other bones started to decay, that industry started to fade away as a health fad. There was a little bit of government involvement there, but not very much, because there wasn't that much authority yet over products like this.
Let me ask you how the campaign of denial around radium played itself out and how it was challenged.
Well, you know, this is an interesting chapter, I think, because there are more examples in this case of the deniers themselves putting themselves at some risk, and there's some evidence that they actually believed this wasn't as dangerous as they had evidence to know that it was. For example, the man who founded Standard Chemical, which would become the nation's greatest radium producer, was a man named Joseph Flannery, and he believed this was going to cure virtually every illness. I mean, he was very, very ardent in his claims that radium was going to make you healthy, whether you suffered from tuberculosis or insanity or cancer or anemia. Ironically, anemia is one of the things radium causes. And he also suggested that the radioactive waste that his company created was just fantastic fertilizer. And he hired a botanist to do a study, and which was in the New York Times, telling the world they should be spreading this stuff on croplands and gardens. He also had it spread on his own garden. And then it turned out a few years later he died of something else, but anemia was listed as a contributing cause of death. So if he believed what he was saying and ate the vegetables in his garden and drank the potions that he was selling, it seems quite likely that radium contributed to his death. There are other cases where we find people who are marketing radium who lived long lives and seemed perfectly healthy, but later on, studies discovered that their bones were very radioactive. So this is one of the strange industries where people who were claiming it clearly were exposed, whether they died or not. And that raises questions, of course. In later industries, it's a lot easier to see that there is so much evidence of harm that clearly the executives defending their product have every reason to know it's there and surely can't believe what they're saying when there is no evidence. In the case of radium, they might have believed it, but I think the important thing here is radium was a substance that was so profoundly dangerous and profoundly mysterious and far more radioactive than something like uranium. People like Thomas Edison said, "This stuff is too dangerous. I am not even going to experiment with it." And yet the industry jumped up and said, "Hey, we'll experiment with it, and we'll experiment on people, and we will do it before we have any evidence that this is actually good for them, and certainly before we have any evidence that it is safe in the long run." So I think the fundamental denial of the radium industry was simply that they didn't need to know, that they could just plunge ahead in ignorance and experiment on the population.
Environmental attorney Barbara Fries is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we're discussing her book, Industrial Strength Denial, 8 Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible from the Slave Trade to Climate Change. Well, tell us then about automobile accidents in mid-century. And in fact, can you sort of paint a picture of the automobile industry in the United States, which was one of the most powerful industries in the world?
Absolutely. Right. So I focus on the period after World War II until roughly the mid-60s. And this is a time when the U.S. economy is booming, and really the auto industry is at the very head of it. The head of GM was named as Time Magazine's Man of the Year. The industry was just, really the strongest in the world. GM was the world's top sort of industrial institution of any kind. It held the most engineers and scientists outside of the military in terms of doing R&D. And the United States in particular was really redesigning itself around the automobile. This is the era of the interstate highway, the era of suburbia, suburban spread, the drive-in. I mean, really, the auto industry was at the top of the world, and the cars were becoming faster and more powerful and more deadly. And what we saw was that as the death toll was rising, and of course there were millions of accidents and tens of thousands of people dying, what the industry managed to do was always focus not on what hurt the driver or the passengers or the other people involved, but on what caused the accident itself, and they always then blamed the driver. And in this way, they kept the question away from, could we make these cars safer? And they were remarkably successful at doing that for a very long time.
And that approach of blaming the victim is one that we'll see runs throughout so many of these cases. So how was this incredibly powerful industry challenged?
Well, it was challenged by outsiders, which is another pattern we see in every one of these. I mean, there are a few whistleblowers, but mainly it is people outside the industry. In the case of the auto industry, we had a lot of the medical establishment challenging them for a long time. We had a lot of lawyers challenging them for a long time. And most famously, we had Ralph Nader writing a book that would get a lot of attention about the auto industry's lack of taking any responsibility for making their cars crash-worthy. And then the industry's own extremely defensive response to Nader's book drew even more attention to the industry's hubris and lack of responsibility. They hired an investigator, GM did, a private investigator to follow Nader, to question people who knew him, clearly trying to dig up dirt. And this was actually a very risky thing for them to do, because Nader was a congressional witness, and intimidating a congressional witness is a crime. So the FBI got involved, GM had to admit that they had hired this investigator, and this was coming out at a time when the states had been very active in trying to get some auto safety in place, and there were now congressional hearings on auto safety, and in that context, the fact that GM had come down so hard on Nader and in such a dishonest way, it really pushed the political power against the auto industry, and the Motor Vehicle Safety Act was passed with surprisingly wide support in Congress.
Well, another campaign of corporate denial that you write about is that also related to automobiles, and that is around leaded gasoline. And the legacy of leaded gasoline stays with us to this day. Can you tell us about how it was that leaded gasoline was found to be so damaging, and how the industry responded to the evidence?
Sure. Well, I mean, there really are kind of two chapters to this particular chapter, in the sense of two points in our history where there was a debate. First, when leaded gas was first discovered, and it was discovered by people at GM, who discovered if you put a little bit of this highly toxic lead compound into gasoline, it made the engines work better, and you could then have more powerful engines. So GM got together with Standard Oil, they formed the Ethyl Corporation, and they started selling leaded gas. But it was known even then that lead was very toxic, and it was the kind of toxin that slowly accumulated in the body and caused lead poisoning. So even then you had the Surgeon General writing to GM and say, wait a minute, is this really a good idea? And GM writing back and effectively saying, well, yeah, we haven't really tested it, but we don't think there will be enough that anybody can detect, you know, either in the environment or in the body. A very unscientific approach to accumulative poison. And we had public health experts speaking up and getting press coverage saying this is very dangerous and it's going to slowly build up in the environment and in our bodies. And the industry essentially prevailed in the 20s. They won by saying, you know, there's just not that much evidence. And the federal authorities were not particularly strong at this time. And the industry stepped up and said, hey, you know, you can trust us. We're not biased, we're totally objective, we're totally fact-based, and if there's any actual harm that is proven, we'll take the lead out of the gasoline. Essentially, they managed to keep the burden of proof on those who were alleging harm so that they didn't have to establish safety. And then the industry itself dominated the science for a good 40 years and basically persuaded the world, to the extent that the world was paying any attention, that lead contamination in the body is totally natural. High lead levels in the blood were natural because lead is an element and it exists in nature, and that it was totally harmless until you got way high, up to about 80 micrograms per deciliter of blood, which is the threshold of clinical lead poisoning. It wasn't until 40 years later, then in the 1960s, that other scientists came forward and said, wait a minute, this is completely wrong. One of them was a geochemist named Claire Patterson, who was simply trying to find out how old the Earth was. He wasn't involved in health or anything like that, but he was involved in measuring lead levels. And his work made it clear that, in fact, lead exposure at that era, it may have been typical to have high blood lead levels, but it was no means natural. It was a result of putting lead into the environment through gasoline and some other means, but largely through gasoline.
And you said that the industry dominated the science for decades around lead. How did it dominate the science?
You know, it's actually kind of amazing how fully they dominated the science, and they did that through one particular individual. His name was Robert Kehoe. He worked for the Ethel Corporation. He was their medical director. He was also on the faculty of the University of Cincinnati, where he received apparently $1 in salary, and the rest of his compensation came from the industry, which funded his laboratory, funded his research. The federal government had been advised in the 20s, I should say Congress had been advised by the Surgeon General to appropriate money to do independent research and to monitor lead exposures and whether it caused any harm, but Congress never got around to doing that. So all the research was done in this one lab by this one individual who was funded by the industry, and he was doing studies and came to dominate the research to the point that when he published his studies in a book and sent that book around to his colleagues, he would receive back letters, you know, saying, the last word in lead has been said, and you are a god in the field. So this one individual managed to dominate this field so thoroughly, and somehow other researchers did not get involved in it for lack of funding. I mean, of course, much scientific research is funded by the federal government, and if the federal government doesn't provide grants, then that is a tremendous vacuum. And so that's how this worked. Eventually, again, I mentioned this geochemist who came at it from a completely different direction. At the same time, there were some pediatricians, including famously a man named Herb Needleman, who did very important research looking largely at the baby teeth of children. So once they had fallen out, you could measure lead levels in their teeth and determine how much exposure they had had, and found these very troubling correlations between what had been considered safe levels of lead exposure and lower IQ and behavioral problems, school problems, eventually later police problems. So this turned out to be both a totally unnatural exposure for generations of people, and not just in the U.S., but globally, with basically causing subtle brain damage to pretty much all of us, certainly all of us born before 1980, unless you lived in a very remote area, and even then you'd have more exposure than would be natural. You know, and so it raises the question, what if you take the sort of bell curve of an entire society and plot their IQ, and then you shift that whole thing to the left a few IQ points, and you have that many more impaired people, that many more brilliant, or that many fewer brilliant people. And you know, I think it can really change a society.
So what then led to the end of lead being put into gasoline, so to speak? You mentioned the evidence, but obviously, as your book actually illuminates, evidence doesn't necessarily translate into the cessation of a harmful activity.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't, at least not as quickly as we'd like. Actually, lead was largely driven out of the gasoline, at least at first, not because of the dangers of lead, but because of other air pollution issues like smog and ozone. And so the federal government wanted to put in catalytic converters and talk to the industry. By this time, the industry, the auto industry, had sold its shares in Ethyl, so this was a separate industry. And the auto industry said in 1970, and keep in mind we've got Earth Day and people are really, you know, concerned. There's a lot of momentum about cleaning up the air around that era. The auto industry said, okay, we're going to put in catalytic converters, and lead destroys catalytic converters. So they said, and therefore we'll have to, you know, move to unleaded gasoline. It still took a number of years to get the lead out of the fuel supply, but that was kind of the beginning of it. And then a few years later, more and more evidence of the harm of lead led to a more direct effort to reduce lead. But, it, you know, this, of course, made the leaded gasoline industry, the Ethyl Corporation in particular, crazy. They accused their critics of being zealots, of being hysterics. They said they were the subject of a witch hunt. And they weren't just talking about, you know, a scientist here and there. They were talking about the federal government. I mean, they really were sort of the poster child of a besieged industry feeling itself unfairly treated and throwing everything out at its critics. Ultimately, they decided, well, okay, they can't deal with the hysteria in the U.S., and they marketed their product more aggressively in other countries.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking today with Barbara Fries. She's an environmental attorney. She's a former Minnesota Assistant Attorney General, and she's the author of Industrial Strength Denial, 8 Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible, From the Slave Trade to Climate Change. That book is published by UC Press and at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to it. She's also the author of Coal, A Human History. Let me ask you about chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, that were produced as a refrigerant and known to destroy the ozone layer. How did it come to pass that the harmful effects of CFCs was known, and how were they ultimately phased out?
Yeah, the harm caused by CFCs to the ozone layer, at first, it wasn't evident at all, but it was theorized, and that makes this a different situation than these other cases where the harm was really evident and then they had to connect the dots. Here, what happened was it was discovered that all the CFCs that had ever been produced were still floating around up in the stratosphere, and scientists, again, outside the industry, Sherwood, Rowland, and Mario Molina were the main two, started to wonder, well, what happens to those chemicals then? And started to be concerned that when they floated up into the stratosphere, they'd be exposed to radiation, ultraviolet radiation. They would break up, and that they would then, the chlorine atoms would start a chain reaction that would destroy the ozone molecules up there, which are really important to screen the rest of us from ultraviolet radiation, those of us down here on the surface. So they were very concerned about this in the 1970s. They raised the alarm within the industry, and at the time, there simply was no evidence that this was actually happening. So there were years of time where that was being studied, but also the industry could mount its own denial campaign. And there were really two industries at play. One was the aerosol industry in the 70s mainly. And they, of course, used used CFCs just as a propellant. It was a way to get hairspray from the can to your head, or to get deodorant from the can to your body. It was a one-time use in fairly trivial products, and it could be easily replaced. The aerosol industry, though, was not at all keen on having to replace CFCs, and they claimed that their critics were alarmist, that maybe this was the KGB was behind this, and there was this very, very powerful argument, or at least a very loud argument, that free enterprise itself was under attack, and so it ended up becoming a very ideological sort of thing. However, the aerosol problem was actually solved fairly quickly in the 70s. The federal government said, you know, we don't know for sure, but this is about catastrophic harm versus a trivial benefit. So we're just going to ban these CFCs, and you, aerosol industry, have a couple years to figure out solutions. And the aerosol industry figured out solutions, and it was just no big deal. You know, the world moved on. But these products were still in refrigeration. They were still being used in air conditioning, and that would prove a much harder technological challenge. And then in 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected. So the concern about the environment that characterized much of the 70s was suddenly turned into a concern about regulation and making sure businesses weren't harmed. And so there was a delay on trying to get the CFCs out of refrigeration and air conditioning, during which time the chemical industry actually stopped even looking for substitutes because they no longer felt they were being challenged. And then in the mid-80s, in 1985, suddenly we have evidence of this massive ozone hole over Antarctica. And that brought tremendous new attention and concern to the issue. Eventually, and I'm skipping an awful lot here, we get to the Montreal Protocol, where the nations of the world admit that or recognize that they've got to cut CFC production. And the chemical industry actually went along with it by later in the 80s because they knew that they could replace CFCs with other chemicals that they could also manufacture and profit from. So in essence, we all sort of got on board to get CFCs slowly out of the economy. And now the ozone layer is healing, apparently. We knew this would be a slow process, and it has been, but it could be seen as a real success story. But it did kind of depend on the fact that the chemical industry wasn't going to defend this chemical forever, because it had lots of other products that it could sell, and including substitutes. And that makes this different than, for example, the tobacco industry or the fossil fuel industry, where the product at the center of these industries is the one that is causing so much harm.
Sure. And let me ask you about the tobacco industry, which is really the poster child for corporate denial, selling what may be the most deadly consumer product on earth in terms of the number of fatalities caused by smoking. Remind us of how long the tobacco industry knew of the harms of tobacco and how they responded to the massive liability that they had created.
Well, you could go back, well into the early 20th century or even earlier, in the sense that people understood, from the very beginning that there were health consequences to consuming tobacco. But the really persuasive studies were emerging in the 50s. And that's when the tobacco industry really got together to put forth a kind of coordinated denial campaign. And what they argued over the years, well, it spans the gamut of different denials. But a lot of it was simply focused on proof and arguing consistently that, that there was no proof that this terrible scourge of lung cancer was related to the spread of cigarettes. Sometimes they would come up with alternative explanations for what might be causing this crazy epidemic of lung cancer, which, statistically it would be a million to one that it would be random that pretty much all of the people getting lung cancer were smoking cigarettes. By the way, lung cancer had been almost unknown earlier in the 20th century, and so that was one of the things that was raising alarm, that this disease was suddenly so widespread. But the industry would claim, for example, that maybe it's genetics or something about the personality of the individual that both made them inclined to smoke and made them inclined to get lung cancer. You also saw the industry frequently offering these bizarre kind of counterfactuals, like if you did not smoke, other bad things would be happening. Like if you weren't smoking cigarettes, who knows what you would do? You might beat your wife. You might drive cars fast. Or they argued that they were basically defending freedom from fascism. They tried to portray those who were concerned about smoking and tried to reduce rates of smoking, would compare them to fascists, compare them certainly to prohibitionists, but ultimately then putting themselves on the side of arguing for freedom and for personal responsibility. That particular argument, the idea of freedom of choice and personal responsibility, became kind of awkward when around in the 1990s they stopped actually being able to deny so many of the harms and argued that, well, basically we have no choice but to sell this product as long as it is legal. So another very effective, I think, approach that the tobacco industry used was to try to compare the risk of smoking to other risks in a way that they could then just minimize the risk. And I think that was effective simply because human beings have a really hard time understanding relative risk. So the industry, for example, would argue that everything is dangerous if you get too much of it. Applesauce is dangerous if you get too much of it. And tobacco is no more addictive than gummy bears or Twinkies or coffee and no more harmful. And I think that worked very well for them for a long time. Another approach that the tobacco industry took, though, and I think we're seeing some of the consequences of this now, was attacking government and trying to drag down the credibility of government and of science. Back in 1986, when the Tobacco Institute was already a joke when it came to whether the public believed what it had to say about the risks of smoking, they called for an investigation of the Surgeon General for abuse of science and scientific censorship. And I don't think they believed they were going to improve their own credibility with the public, and indeed they did not. But this, I think, was an early salvo in what turned out to be decades of effort by not just the tobacco industry, but by various groups that they would then fund, think tanks, free market advocacy groups, and that then other industries would also fund, that would then immediately challenge any effort by the government to regulate any industry, claiming it was based on junk science and you could not trust the government, you could not trust these scientists. And I think the fossil fuel industry would end up being one of the main beneficiaries of that attack because, basically a major segment of our society was taught via right-wing radio, right-wing television, and these various free market groups that you cannot trust the government, you cannot trust expertise itself. It became kind of a very populist argument. And I think it really did help bring about our current sort of post-truth era where you then have a major segment of your society voting for Donald Trump, for example, because, even if he says things that run entirely counter to science, they don't trust the scientists anyway. And of course, with COVID, we're seeing another one of the problems that result when that happens.
Indeed. Barbara Fries is my guest. She's an environmental attorney. We're talking about her book, Industrial Strength Denial. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, in the memories of most of us, is the unfolding and catastrophe of the global financial crisis. And spurring that financial crisis was the financial services industry. Can you talk about the way that they mounted a campaign of denial about the sorts of products that they were selling and that imperiled the global economy?
Right. Well, that crisis has been widely attributed to the mortgage-backed investment products that were widely sold and that ultimately failed when the housing bubble burst. And the way this happened was you had a couple of different industries that were working together. One was this new industry of mortgage lenders that were going out there and using very aggressive and indeed very predatory and often fraudulent lending practices, focusing largely on the least sophisticated financial consumers, the people with the least money. They might have a very safe government-backed mortgage on their house, but they could use money to pay the bills and they'd be persuaded to buy or to take out these incredibly risky mortgages with hidden, with adjustable rates that would spring up later, which they couldn't then pay off unless they took out another mortgage. And that little process worked as long as the housing bubble continued to inflate. Obviously, that bubble wasn't going to inflate forever, but among the kinds of denial that drove this behavior was the denial that bubble would ever burst. And what happened then was all of this incredibly risky and toxic debt was created. And the reason it could be created, because of course that's not a very good business model to sell mortgages to people who can't pay them back, the reason it worked is that Wall Street would then buy these mortgages, lump them together, mix them up, slice them and dice them, and turn them into investment products, and claim that in so doing the inherent risk of these very shaky mortgages had been diminished, and that these had been turned then into very safe investment products, and they would sell them to the investment community. So there was so much denial here. One, of course, was that the housing prices would ever stop going up. One was that you could safely let lending standards go way down, and that that wasn't going to threaten your financial system. Another major form of denial was around whether these financial markets needed to be regulated or whether they could somehow regulate themselves. And some of the financial products in question were derivatives, this new category of financial product that really did hide and disperse risk in ways that made them very mysterious and unpredictable. And there was an effort in the 90s to regulate derivatives, and Wall Street fought that back, arguing that nope, the industry itself knows how to regulate itself and will be self-disciplined and keep things safe. And then, of course, that we went on to the next step where the regulations put in place after the Great Depression were challenged, and members of Congress and the White House were convinced that we didn't need them anymore, and the financial industry was deregulated in a way that allowed this whole pipeline of toxic debt to really accelerate and spread even further. And so then finally, of course, the housing bubble does break, then all of this debt comes due, and people don't know where the risk is, and that's basically how we saw the financial system very nearly collapse.
The eighth case that you look at in your book, Barbara Fries, is that of the fossil fuel industry and the looming catastrophe of climate change. And you mentioned at the beginning of the program that you were personally involved in cross-examining the claims of the coal industry in your state, Minnesota. Of all the campaigns of denial, well, in fact, almost all of them that you write about affect millions of people. In the case of climate change, of course, it affects billions of people. It affects the entire population of the globe. And I wondered if you could talk about the ways that the fossil fuel industry has drawn lessons from the corporate denial campaigns of the past, and also whether or not, looking at all of these examples of corporate denial, there are lessons that we can also draw from those cases in terms of challenging the fossil fuel industry.
Sure. Well, certainly there were plenty of lessons that the fossil fuel industry could draw from almost all of these industries. Blaming the victim is the one thing that doesn't really work when it comes to climate, but pretty much all of the other forms of denial could be used. One they have used most effectively is to always keep the burden of proof on those alleging danger, never having to prove safety. I mean, it doesn't even seem to make sense in our political dialogue to imagine asking the fossil fuel industry to prove robustly that we can continue down this totally unprecedented path and not face catastrophe. They've never been required to prove that. And so they've just been able to try to attack the evidence of harm and keep the debate on that. And of course, by putting the burden of proof on their critics, they claim the benefit of every doubt, and then they have a very strong incentive to exaggerate that doubt. Another thing we've certainly seen is the fundamental tribalism that emerged in almost all of these denial campaigns, which is to accuse your critics of ulterior motives and to really claim for your own industry these very lofty goals of defending the world. And in the case of the fossil fuel industry, this has become largely it's taken on actually a very effective, I think, populist tone. Instead of claiming that they're defending the world from communism, which we heard from over in the debate over ozone, and that does appear now and then with fossil fuels, but now it's more likely they're going to claim that they're defending, you know, basic good old working Americans from an elite, a deceptive elite that's somehow trying to raise their energy prices and make money off of some kind of a fake crisis. One thing we've seen a lot, though, with the climate, with the fossil fuel industry, is projection of whatever criticism can be more legitimately brought against them against others. So you will hear them claiming that those who are worried about climate change are just greedy, that it's basically just scientists who want to get funding from the government, and so they're pretending that this is a problem. They claim that they're that those concerned about climate change are dishonest. It's been called a hoax by everybody from Donald Trump to, you know, well, much of the Republican Party. You see them claiming that those trying to deal with climate change have some very sinister political agenda. And what's astonishing there is to recognize that a lot of the climate denial from the various sort of think tanks and right-wing advocacy groups that we hear, a lot of that has been funded by the Koch network, Koch Industries, the Koch Foundations, and the various groups that they have founded. And they truly do have a very radical political agenda in terms of trying to get the government out of pretty much everything, roll back virtually all of the progress that's been made in the 20th century about environmental or consumer protections, and really put in place the kind of a world of where the markets dominate everything, a world that really has never existed. And is such an extreme agenda that if they were being very honest about it, I just don't think they would get very much support. So I think we've seen that this industry has learned a lot from what has been successful in the other industries. As for your other question of what have we learned and in terms of looking back at this history, I'm afraid part of it is simply persistence. I mean, I wish that there was some magic formula that I could point to from these chapters that works, but I think it is simply talking a lot about this issue, and I'm happy to see we're finally talking about it a lot more than we used to. Basing your arguments on the evidence and getting that out there. And also, I think it is very important to appeal not just, again, to the brain and in terms of evidence and risk, but to the heart and to the morality by pointing out, you know, that this is really an immoral thing, that we are destroying our climate, destabilizing our climate, and putting such deep, deep costs on not just future generations, but people alive today, and including many people who did not contribute very much at all to this problem.
I'd like to end by asking you about the psychology of the industry representatives involved in denial. You write that financial self-interest has a powerful effect on people's willingness to bend the truth, but that's not the only driver. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think it's very important to look beyond the simple question of money and greed here, and to recognize that the people working for these corporations and acting in their name are social animals, just like all of us, and that we've got the side of us that wants to pursue self-interest, but we also have a pro-social side. And generally speaking, those two instincts kind of keep each other in check. But they are also very responsive to social influence, to circumstantial influence, and to incentives. And so that's why we have to look at the corporation and how does it influence our behavior. And basically what it does is it very strongly enhances the side of us that's pursuing self-interest and money. And unfortunately mutes the side of us that is feeling responsible towards society and wants to minimize harm and actually contribute to society. And the way it does that is, first of all, through division of labor. Once we divide up labor, we tend to feel less responsible for the harm that the group we are working for or working within is causing. It does it by dividing management from ownership. Shareholders don't feel responsible for the harm a corporation may cause because, first of all, they're far away. They may not know what's going on, and they may just own those shares in a sort of temporary transactional nature. And the executives of the corporations may not feel any sense of responsibility for the harm they cause because, to the extent that they feel responsible for others, they feel like it's their job to maximize shareholder profits. So you have this very dangerous situation where pro-social instincts and the sense of responsibility are muted, where money becomes extremely salient, including short-term returns. And then you have it all basically propped up through a very justifying ideology, from Milton Friedman to the Koch brothers and market fundamentalism, or you could even go back to Adam Smith and the notion that the invisible hand will turn the pursuit of self-interest in the markets into broader social benefits, and so you don't have to worry about causing harm. And so that creates the corporation as, I think, a potentially very dangerous institution, and one that needs to be monitored and regulated and watched by the other segments of our society. Unfortunately, government has played that role largely in the past, but right now, in particular, we see corporate influence over government to be so strong that it really isn't acting as a check and balance to corporate power.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Sasha. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Barbara Fries is the author of Industrial Strength Denial, 8 Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible from the Slave Trade to Climate Change. That book's published by UC Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to it. Barbara Fries is a former Minnesota Assistant Attorney General and an environmental attorney. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.